You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. We've got a potluck for you. This is where you submit the questions and we answer. Please send us your questions. Go to syntax.fm. Top right corner is a button. You can smack it and type your question in the box and we will answer it on the podcast. We've got some really good questions for you today. A really good one about like caching API and speeding up API data. Svelte and SvelteKit. How do you generate a PDF on the server side these days? Are PHP CMSs better than JavaScript CMSs? Is Stripe the new PayPal? All kinds of really good stuff. We are sponsored by three awesome companies today. Prismic is the headless CMS that makes it easy to build web pages. Auth0 makes it login and permission for your application super easy. And LogRocket JavaScript Session Replay. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode. With me, as always, is Mr. Scott Tolinsky. We both just got off a week of vacation. How you doing?
Hey, man, I'm jet lagged. I look like a demon. My eye is completely red. We had a child emergency room trip, and I could be doing better. We'll just say that. But yeah, for the most part, everything's been great, man. We were just in Hawaii. We were in Oahu with the fam and Travis Nielsen and his family, and it was just super cool. We got to hang out with everybody and see a lot of great stuff. So we had a blast. We got to go to the like Jurassic Park filming locations and stuff, and just an endless amount of cool things in Hawaii. So feeling like I need another week to recover from kind of an epic vacation.
For your vacation. Yeah.
When you have a vacation with a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, it's not really a vacation.
No.
Yeah. It's kind of just like pure chaos is really
exhausting.
Exhausting. Yeah.
We just got off a week at our cottage, but our whole extended family came up, and that is always really nice because people take nights cooking and like people can watch the kids while you do something. So that's feeling good about
sounds
that.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah. I've been working on my office. And so we just moved to a new house. I've been working on soundproofing and building an office in the basement. So I'm like, I was half trying to record my TypeScript course and half working on that thing. And I was getting kind of tired. I'm very happy that I'm a web developer because doing physical stuff is hard.
Doing physical stuff is hard. That's the truth.
All right, let's get on into it. First question is from Chris F. I'm working on a Jamstack app that fetches JSON from a third-party API. However, this API changes multiple times a day and takes a couple of seconds to retrieve every single time. The couple of seconds wait time is annoying, and I want to improve this. For my use case, I only need the updated from the API once a day. To potentially remedy this, I'm wondering if there's a way to create a middleman to fetch the data from the API once a day. I would then fetch this middleman from the middleman instead, rather than directly from the third party and waiting a couple of seconds every single time. Is this possible? Is there a way to work around this? I haven't dug really into the serverless functions. Wondering if this would be a good use case for it. Yes, this is an awesome question. And this is very, very common because APIs can either be slow or APIs can be limited. And generally, like I'll give an example. I have a currency conversion API, and I'm only allowed to hit it 60 times a day or something like that. And if I were to hit that every single time I loaded the page, that would be a bad day, and I would go over that limit very quickly. So the solution to that is you cache the data, or you put a middleman proxy. And at the very, very basic, this can simply just be a variable in your server or in a serverless function. So what you can do is outside of the scope of where you fetch the data, you create a variable sometimes I do in an object. And that object will have two properties, a date property and a data property. And the date will give me the date that data was last refetched. And the data will give me the data that was returned from the API. And then generally, I'll have another function that says like fetch currencies. And what will happen is it will first check that object to see, is there data in here? And if so, is it stale? You know, and then you can go ahead and if it is, you just return it from the object. If not, you go ahead and fetch it fresh from the thing. And I really like that approach because it just stores that data in memory. And if it's something small, like a single request or maybe even a couple hundred requests, it's fine to store that in an object. That object will go away if you ever turn off your server and restart it. But in my case, that's fine because I'm not restarting it more than 60 times a day. And in your case, it's probably a good idea as well. A serverless function is a great use case for this because serverless functions will hold memory for, I forget what the thing is, but it will hold it for at least 40, 50, sometimes even a couple hours. And that's great because you can just make a variable outside of the serverless function handler. I do this for all of my OpenGraph images on my website. I don't even store the image anywhere. Past that, you probably would want to stick it in a database and then fetch it from the database. Or even if you're using a traditional server, stick it in a text file and just pull it from there. And that's a great way to speed this type of thing up.
I was thinking Redis myself. We use Redis for this type of thing on our site. So it can be really easy if you have I know our host, like render.com, has like a really nice and easy way to spin up a private service, like a render private service, and then just connect to it directly from a function or something like that. So yeah, I like your idea about memory. If you want a little bit more control, you can go to Redis. And then if you need a little bit more control, you can go to a database or, like you mentioned, a text file or something like that. But I think you nailed it on this one.
Yeah, pretty common thing to do. I use this approach quite a bit.
Totally. Cool. Next question is from James. Or from Todd. Next question is from Todd, not James. Todd. Todd says, I've been getting into Svelte and SvelteKit the last couple of weeks, and I'm really loving. I'm considering doing a training with my team to get them to work full, to get them up to speed so that we could use it for future projects. My only concern is that it's not yet on version 1, and there are likely some APIs that will change before it gets there. I don't want to give my team too much whiplash in that regard. Should I wait a little bit before I introduce it to them, or are they fine learning about it? Now, Todd, this question is aptly timed because I don't know if you saw, Wes, but there was a lot of discussion yesterday and the days before on major SvelteKit API changes. So, you know, one of the things that they're wanting to do is to get SvelteKit to be what it needs to be before it hits version 1. Once it hits version 1, any API change they've made before version 1 is locked into essentially version 1 stone, right? Not that it can't be changed, but if you make a big API change after it hits version 1, then you're going to cause a lot more trouble than if you did it before version 1. And what they have done is basically said, you know what? We have some issues with how load functionality works. You might remember from using SvelteKit West, you have like the context module, and then you do that inside of like a load function to load your data for code that runs client and server side. And they just found that there was a lot of confusion around that. Not only that, basically there was, this is like almost worthy of an entire episode of syntax to discuss, essentially the amount of like different things that they wanted to discuss. Basically, file system based routing being potentially confusing, right? There's a lot of edge cases. There's a lot of like weird little things. And this isn't just unique to SvelteKit. This is like file-based routing overall, right? The load function and a bunch of just essentially small little things, but they've gone and made what I would consider to be like a massive change to the API, especially in the file system based routing. Like there will no longer be index.svelte files to do index inside of routes. You can now no longer define routes as files. So like in the past, you could have like an about.svelte in your routes folder, and that would be an about route. And so now routes can only be defined by a folder itself. And inside of that folder, there's like a really interesting like decorator to a file, the plus character. So it'd be like plus page.svelte. And that's like the page of the route. So there's like a ton of change right now. So I would hold off, Todd, because I think this is going to be the last big change in SvelteKit before it hits version 1. But this is a big change. So if you're paying attention to the Svelte landscape, you know, right now you've probably noticed all the discussion about this. If you haven't been, go read the discussion on GitHub. I'll post a link to that in the show notes. There's a whole lot there. They're working on a migration script and everything, but it's going to be part of a big component of when you're teaching SvelteKit, the types of things that you need to teach in regards to here. So yeah, hold off for right now and make sure you stay up to date with this little bit.
That beautifully timed question. I'm glad that Todd
that's why
asked
I added
that.
It. Yeah. I saw no it coming kidding. And I was like, yeah, okay, this is a perfect one. Yeah.
Next question we have here from James. What options do we have for generating PDFs server-side nowadays? We use WKHTML to PDF, which uses WebKit for layout at work. And the project seems to have been stopped being actively developed and has an old version of WebKit with a buggy 2009 implementation of Flexbox. Ooh. Makes developing templates a pain. The only viable options seem to be low-level libraries that make you call and create blocks and cells, images and text by hand, or installing a browser server controlling it by Puppeteer and all the resources that comes with that. Have I missed a hidden gem when Googling? A nice CLI that takes an HTML file and returns a PDF. This is a great question. I like this a lot because previously doing PDFs, and you can see this sometimes when you get the bill from your electrical or your gas company, is like those PDFs were generated with some sort of special PDF software, and it's very hard to lay things out on that. And ideally now is you just use the things that you know, HTML and CSS, to lay it out. And then you click a button and out pops the other end as a PDF. So what are the possible options on there? So the answer to that is, I've got four answers here. First, a service. That tends to be the way that a lot of people go, is they say, well, let's just use a service for that. I'm not a big fan of that because it's another thing you have to pay for. Now you're sending, if you're doing like receipts or something like that, your customer's info is now on a third party. I'm not a big fan of that. Second one, and this is the option I have, is just tell people to save it themselves. So I do my receipts and invoices and the PDF that says you completed the course. All of that is just an HTML page, and I have instructions on how to do it. And in the early days, I got a lot of people being like, how do I make a PDF of this? I need a PDF to send to my employer. It's like, well, just do file, print, save as PDF. That has gone away completely because I both have instructions, but also I think people sort of know that now. So that's one option, is just tell people to do it yourself.
And Wes, let me interject here for a quick second. I'm going to say we do the same thing, but we don't even have instructions on how to do that. And I get no email at all. So
I think it's sort of like well known now. This is probably 6 years ago. I was getting some support questions from that. How do I make a PDF? So that is a great approach. Next one is DOM to PDF. So if you can do it in the browser, the question here says server side. But if you're only doing it on demand, like someone's viewing a receipt and they want a PDF version of it, you can dump that DOM into a Canvas element with this library called HTML to Canvas. And then you can take your Canvas and export that to PDF with another library. And that can all be done in the browser, but that's a lot to be putting in the customer's browser, depending on that working. And the HTML canvas has some issues, not because HTML canvas, but canvas itself, you cannot draw if you have a third image on another host, you can't draw that to canvas because of cores issues. You can't taint I always love the warning that you get from canvas when you try draw, like if you've got scott.com image and I'm trying to write that on a canvas on west.com, and there's no cores security policies in place, it'll say it's been tainted. And like, you can't do that. And I'm like, ooh, tainted. That's like poison. So that's an okay solution. But I probably wouldn't go that. And the last one here is that what you suggested is Puppeteer. I did a quick Google and it seems like a lot of the solutions still use Phantom.js, which has been not abandoned, but it's been deprecated for 4 years now. So Puppeteer essentially is Chromium or Chrome running headlessly. And then what you can do from that is take screenshots. You can render out HTML pages. And of course, you can export something to a PDF. So honestly, what I'm going to tell you here is this is a perfect use case for a serverless function. This is a lot of complexity, a lot of dependencies, not necessarily a lot of dependencies, but this is a bunch of stuff that can be so neatly tied into a serverless function. You can still do the rendering of the HTML page on your own server, whatever you're using, but you can make a nice little tidy serverless function that takes in a URL and then renders it out, exports it to PDF, and sends it back to you. So I think that's the approach that you should go with here.
Yeah, long story short is it's not effortless, that's for sure.
No.
yeah. And the effortless answer is to just have your users save it themselves if that's cool with you. All right, next. Actually, maybe we should take a quick second to talk about one of our sponsors today, Prismic. Wes, do you want to dive into Prismic?
Yes, Prismic is a headless CMS that's going to turn your website into growth engine. So Prismic is a hosted service. You sign up for it, and right away you can go ahead and start modeling your data. And you sort of model your data into pieces of data, people, courses, you name it. And then what you can do is you can create slices, which are sort of collections of those pieces. And then from those slices, you can make websites. And that's really cool because your people who are using your marketing folks, your lawyers, whoever's using the actual end CMS of your website can input all of that data and then collect all of those together via slices. And then you, the developer on the other end, can query the API. And of course, it's going to give you the data, but then it will also give you the slices for each of those pages. And then you will render out components that are sort of one-to-one with each of those slices. So I've got a customer component that's going to render out to the customer data. And that's cool because it's essentially a website builder at that point, because you don't have to make the pages yourself. You just query them from Prismic. I think that's a really cool way to approach building websites. You want to check it out at prismic.io/syntax. They've got an awesome landing page there, tons and tons of really good starter files there. Check it out, prismic.io/syntax. Thank you, Prismic, for sponsoring.
Sick. Cool. Nice. It's funny, Wes. So one of the potluck questions, I don't know if you saw that, was critiquing the way that we say thank you to our sponsors. I'm just going to tell anybody listening to this stuff right now, if you come to this podcast for proper linguistics, this is not the right place. Because Wes and I are good at one thing.
I always wondered why you said it that way, though. So I thought it was funny.
You thought it was weird that I said it that way, and you never told me that it was weird?
Maybe I should have, but I don't. It seems like a jerk. So you say, thanks for Prismic for sponsoring. You say, thanks for Prismic for sponsoring.
Thank you for Prismic.
And it should be, thank you to Prismic for sponsoring.
Are you sure?
Prismic.
That's what I say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was just like, oh, that's just the way he says it, but maybe I should have.
It sounds weird when you say it. Yeah. it is just the way I say it. And there are things that I intentionally say oddly, but this is not one of those. So, well, thank you to
as Eminem once said, I don't know. It's just the way I am.
Yeah. Yeah. He did say that. Yeah, he did. Mr. Marshall Mathers. Okay. Next question is from Anon. Anon has a really great flattery tag in here. It's just like a flattery HTML because, nice little placeholder for some, you know,
it's a web component.
Necessary flattery. I'll take it, Anon. How would you compare the trade-offs to working at a tech company versus working at an agency versus freelancing versus entrepreneurship or whatever categories you'd like to compare? Curious to hear about stress, compensation, time requirements, etc., and how you'd go about choosing. This actually sounds like a great episode, like a full-on episode. We could talk a lot about this stuff. I have worked, let's see, how many of these? I have worked all four of these. So, you know, in terms of mental health, the agency life for me was probably the best because you got to work on a bunch of new projects all the time. You got to work on a bunch of different types of things. You didn't have to hold on to a code base for a super long time. You could push it out and work on something new. Freelancing was probably the worst for me because I'm not a great communicator. I'm a better developer than communicator in terms of like staying on top of communication, not like teaching or those types of things. I think entrepreneurship is the most stressful, but also the most rewarding.
Yeah.
Because, dang, there's nothing like not knowing what your income will be for a given month. So that's a lot of fun. But at the end of the day, you know, you get to make your own decisions. And I'm the type of person who I like to do that kind of thing. So, yeah, we should maybe, you know, this doesn't seem like a super fleshed out answer, but I think what we should do is take a whole episode to talk about this.
I just put it in the list. I'll save my answer.
I think that's smart. So, Anand, thank you for the good question. We will answer it in a full-on episode for you.
Yeah, because I've worked for agencies as a freelancer. I've worked freelancer directly to a client. Obviously, entrepreneurship is my main. I've never worked for a tech company before, though, but it'd be kind of interesting to
talk about that. It was a crappy startup that didn't go anywhere. So, maybe not the true tech company experience.
Yeah. All right, next question we have here is from Med. I've been in web development for a while. I'm talking pre-HTML5 and CSS 3 days. Hey. For the past few years, I've been more into JS and have pretty much been coasting on CSS. I must admit, I'm still more comfortable with float-based layouts than Flexbox or Grid. I promise I don't use floats anymore, though. LOL. But as more time goes on, my CSS is getting worse. Don't get me wrong. I can still do what I need, but I struggle with the newest properties. I am not fully comfortable with Flexbox and Grid. I'm pretty much coding CSS like when CSS 3 came out, plus Flexbox. What's the best way for me to catch up? It seems like there are many new topics. This is a good one because life gets busy. You get comfortable doing what you're doing. You get good at doing what you're doing with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I certainly do that all the time where I'm like,
I just want to get it done.
Yeah, I just want to get this done. I know how to do it with this tech. Let me just get out of my way. Let me do it how I know how to do it. And in a lot of cases, that's totally fine. But the other thing about our industry is that it does move at a medium speed where you do have to catch up. Like we're the stuff he's talking about is like Flexbox has been out for what?
Sure.
8 years, you know?
But the industry overall, I would say, moves kind of at like cheetah speed.
It's true. Absolutely. Breakneck speed. But like, I think the fundamentals move a little slower than that. So honestly, I think for you, it's not about like, oh my gosh, like I have been out of it for 8 years and now I have to get back into it, which is unfortunately the case. But for most people, it's do 20 minutes a week and sort of check it out. So this podcast is a great way to keep up to date with what is new, and you'll hear us talking about it. And then I think it's up to you to try to at least implement some of that new CSS stuff, even though like, okay, do your next website in Grid. You're going to be so slow. You're going to be so mad. You're going to think Grid is dumb. Why? Because it's brand new to you and you've never used it before and you don't know how to use it. And things are much harder than if you could just float that sucker and call it a day, right? But honestly, the answer to that is you have to just build stuff every single week. And if you've been out of practice for a couple of years on some of this, maybe set yourself a goal, create a list of 10 things and say, I'm going to make 3 projects that implement all of these 10 things so I can get really comfortable.
Yeah. And you know what? I totally agree. And especially in the topics of Flexbox and Grid that we have here, where even though there is a barrier to entry in terms of learning it, once you learn it, you're going to have such a different change of opinion, I think, because I cannot imagine not using some of these tools nowadays in the ease in which I'm able to do the layouts I want to do without having to add extra wrappers or worry about extraneous things. Once you learn Flexbox and Grid, you're going to absolutely feel the hype about them. You will feel the hype train because they're lovely. In fact, I was just doing, like just the other day, Wes, I had like a grid and I wanted a promo space that took up extra spaces in that grid.
Yeah.
You know, took up like 2 rows and 2 columns. And I was just thinking, man, this would have been a major bummer to try to do any other way. And the fact that I could just say, hey, you know, take up this column and this width or this column, this row and this row for one particular item and have that item live at the bottom of the DOM. I didn't have to like insert it in its specific spot in the DOM. And it just popped right in the right correct spot in the layout, man. It was just lovely. So
good.
Yeah. So take the time. This is one of those ones, especially in relation to CSS stuff, where you're not gonna like the way it used to work after you pick these up.
I forgot to plug my own stuff, CSSGrid.io.
Can I plug my own stuff first?
Go for it.
No, you plug your stuff.
I have a CSS Grid course, from fundamentals to real world in 4 hours. So this is not like you could probably set aside a couple, like, I don't know, 2 hours a night, do it in 3 nights. It's a quick course, and it literally teaches you absolutely everything about CSS Grid. So it doesn't take that long. And then once you know it, you know it.
Once you know it, you got it. I'm going to also plug my course. I have a course called Modern CSS Layouts. It's actually like one of my favorite courses. If we were to like list my top 10 favorite courses, this is probably definitely one of my top 10 favorite courses that I've made, because it teaches you Flexbox and Grid, but then we build like TweetDeck with it, and we build like actual layouts that you would want to use. So I don't know, man. I think, like I said, this is the type of thing, once you get into it, you're just going to love using this stuff. So yeah, pick a course, YouTube, Wes's course, my course, who cares? Just dive into it and get to it. Next question is from Andre Nettles. He says, hey, Wes and Scott, I'm wondering what you think about TRPC. I saw some YouTube videos about it, and I think it's pretty interesting. I also found this project here to get started, and he links to Create T3 App. So we've had a number of requests to talk about TRPC on this podcast. TRPC, Wes, have you dove into TRPC at all? Have you heard those four words or four
letters
together?
Somebody mentioned it. We mentioned it a couple potlucks ago, but not really. I don't really understand. Like, it's like a TypeScript version of GraphQL?
No. It's closer to just straight up REST. So TRPC allows you to build and consume fully type safe APIs without schemas or code generation. So they're kind of like, you know, they're taking a look at this and saying, you know what, GraphQL is so good because of a lot of the type based things, right?
Yeah.
But GraphQL is heavy. You have to have a client and a server. You have to have
big
schemas.
Buy-in.
You got to do a lot of stuff to get you there. And once you're there, it's fine. But getting there is no fun many times. So this looks like it's really all about, like, what if we had a better interface for working with APIs that were more type safe than working in straight up REST without having to have like major buy-in. And a lot of people seem to really love it. Now, I checked out, somebody did like a SvelteKit TRPC starter kit and that's like the most that I've dove into TRPC. this is one of those things that's on my list. I'm going to do a deep dive in it, especially to do like a what is course. I'm going to do definitely a TRPC course on Level Up at some point. So I'm going to have to like spend some major time with it. But it is. It's type-saved APIs without having essentially the bulk of something like GraphQL. And I got to say, I like the idea behind it. I struggle because I'm the type of person that if I see something like this, I'm afraid that I'm going to like it too much. I'm just afraid that I'm going to like it too much, and I don't want to like it too much because I have too many other things to do right now. So I'm going to have to take a deep dive look at this at some point, but really interesting.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. We'll have to do a follow-up show on it.
We'll have to follow that up really quick, like we were zooming in a rocket, like a log rocket. Log Rocket. There we go. Log Rocket, one of our sponsors today, is the perfect place to see how your application is functioning with modern front-end monitoring and product analytics. Now, this is actually really interesting because for a long time, Log Rocket was just the error and exception service where you got a scrubbable video replay to see all of your users' errors happening in your browser. And like that alone is pretty much a killer feature, but then they've gone and added a ton of really awesome things. So it's like their core product was the session replay tool, and they have the session replay tool where you get to see these user interactions, and that works so well for bug hunting. But they were like, well, what if we also use that same thing to give our users ability to see like user experience analytics. So now you can do things like not only stop guessing why bugs happen, but you can surface issues that impact conversion rates, and you can understand why and how people are using your website in the way that they are. You can convert, engage, and retain customers. Me personally, I was using two separate services for doing this type of thing. So I'm really psyched that LogRocket has added these, because I was already liking using LogRocket. So now I can just only use LogRocket. So what we're going to want to do is head on over to logrocket.com/syntax. Sign up and you'll get 14 days for free. Thank you to LogRocket for sponsoring.
I was just looking, I just keep thinking about this PDF question we had a couple of things ago. And I was like, this has got to be an easier way to do it.
I just keep thinking about this PDF question. This
yeah.
The kind so of thing you'll only hear on this podcast.
Someone made a Cloudflare worker that does it in 80 lines of code, which seems to be very, very short. And it's using a dependency called JSPDF. And I didn't mention that one because it's a library. Well, it uses HTML to canvas. That's the thing we had. But if it's running in a worker, they must have done something to make it work in a worker, or it just works in a worker. So
yeah, it feels like HTML to canvas could have been a decent solution there as well, because then you don't have to worry about like browser flexbox features if you're converting the HTML to a canvas first and then using that canvas to save as the PDF.
But like, what if it's running in a worker, what is it using to like do flexbox to lay out, you know? That's the question I have.
Oh, right. Yeah. You know, so,
it works though.
Have you used HTML to canvas before? That's like a really interesting project to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Like many years ago, probably at least like eight years ago, I used it on my own website where I think I wanted to do like blurring on like when you open something, you want to blur the background. That was before we had CSS blur. So I did that. I took a screenshot of the current page and then blurred that. It was so cool.
Dude, when I worked at Ford, and it was like right when kind of Apple had like released all of their blurry kind of UI stuff.
Yeah.
The Ford designers were all like, we got to put blur UI on everything now. and I made like a prototype using exactly the same HTML to canvas, blurred it up, and then used that as like the background image or whatever on the div to do a blur of the thing behind it. And the other devs thought it was kind of like magic, because we're just like, oh man, this is not something. Like when we first got given those blurry design comps, we're all like, we're screwed. We're toast. They didn't end up using any of that, of course, but it was a fun experiment. It's funny that we did the exact same thing with it.
That was good. That's funny that we did. Like the amount of overlap we have in our lives from before we met was unreal.
Yeah. It's very cool.
Cool. All right. Next question we have here is from Mike, how do you feel about keeping separate accounts for things on Twitter? I have accounts that I use for my old Xbox gamer tag and made new ones for my professional account that use my real name. I feel like this is good for discoverability to allow interested people to see my work, but without being spammed with personal things like politics, games, etc. But it also seems less personal and makes more work constantly switching accounts. Thanks for the great show. This is a good one. As I always go back and forth on my thoughts on this, because I think like if you are really into something, like you are really into gardening or gaming or something like that, and you want to have like a total separate account, I think that's not a bad thing. However, mm-hmm. I also do appreciate when people sort of mix their personal lives with their professional. That's why I like Twitter, and you see what people are cooking or working on or things like that. Because like we said, developers are not single lane. They have other interests in that. So I think if you just like to pepper it in, maybe 50% of your tweets can be personal. I think that is totally fine. And I actually enjoy that. It's like Scott posts breakdancing stuff and kids stuff, and I like seeing that stuff as much as I like seeing the code stuff. So
I often worry about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you? What do you think?
I worry about posting my like dance stuff, because I worry that like people are gonna be like, I don't care about this. So yeah. I like try not to do it too much, because you know, I go to practice every week and I'm always taking footage of my practices to help me like find where it's better, could be better. And it's like I could post that stuff And some people seem like they really want to see it and other people don't. So it's like, I'll do it like maybe once every other week, or I'll keep it on a weekend. I have like a little bit of a forethought to it, because it's like, if people are following me for web dev stuff, like I get it. Like, I don't want to be just the, I don't want to be single focused. I'm not a single faceted human being, but in the same regard, like, you know, I'm subscribing to some people for some things. And if they start posting about other things all the time, then I'm not going to subscribe to that person anymore.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a conversation to be had there. And I do agree with you. I like seeing the personal stuff. I like seeing people's hobbies, especially like what I don't want is necessarily someone's hobby to become their main feed, especially if like I'm following them as a developer and not as like, I don't want to say as a human being, because I'm following everyone as a human being, but like, you know, especially people I don't know personally, like I'm maybe following them for projects they're working on or something like that. So I don't know. There's definitely a weird conversation to be had there. I've always had a Level Up Tuts or a Level Up Tutorials account, as well as an S. Tolinsky account. And in the past, my Level Up Tutorials account was my quote unquote business account. My Scott Tolinsky was my personal one, but I've kind of, you know, since had S. Tolinsky just be my main account, and then we do mostly marketing on Level Up Tutorials one. And that's kind of where I've been taking it. I don't have a personal one. I don't have like a, what do they don't call those burner accounts, do they? What do they call those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You have like a, that's exactly what it is, a burner account.
Or they call them an alt. Is that
an alt?
I don't have an alt.
Go nuts on, you can often see, sometimes people will send me a nasty thing and then they'll delete it right away. And I was like, you thought you were on your alt.
You thought you were on your alt.
What you did. But with TweetDeck, it comes in right away. So if you send me something nasty, you delete it, it stays there. I saw it.
Yeah, those alts, man, those are tricky. Like, you can just like see like either bots or alts responding to like comments being like, yes, I agree with this man right here.
I also say, like, I use Instagram way more for personal stuff.
Like,
for example, I'm doing house stuff. I'm not going to post every single little house thing on my Twitter. Every now and then I'll post a little thing or cooking. But all of that, Instagram is just a dump for literally all that. And I don't post a lot of, like, every now and then I'll post coding stuff to Instagram, but I post all my coding stuff to Twitter. So I think it's also about finding balance about that type of stuff.
Yes. Yeah, if you want to see me dancing more, I post way more to Instagram. Also, my children dancing. I'm frequently posting my kids dancing. Next question from Waluigi. Oh my God, Wayne. He's a Waluigi here.
What is that? What's that?
Oh,
you're gonna have to explain this to me,
Wes. You just got a Nintendo Wii. You're gonna have to know who Waluigi is. Oh, it's like
the Hamburglar from Mario.
Yeah, he's the evil Luigi, okay?
When did that guy come out? I don't remember him.
Bro, he's been out for like since like 2000, like 2000, like early 2000. For a long,
first
very
appearance,
long time.
Mario Tennis in 2000.
Whoa, 2000 on the dot?
I'm impressed. It's from N64. Yeah.
Yes, I know. He's been around forever. He's not new. Yes. And you know Wario? Do you know who Wario is? The evil Mario?
I've definitely heard Wario before.
Okay, I was going to say, because Wario's been around since the Game Boy, like very long time here. So Waluigi says, thanks for all you guys do. Y'all are my heroes. Waluigi, you're my hero. Okay. I know using classes typically means that you are not doing functional programming, but does using prototypes mean you're not doing functional programming too? Using prototypes, at least using them without new, feels very much like composition and functional, but classes are prototypes under the hood, so I don't know. Also, no one else seems to be using prototypes straight up anymore and use classes. Would you recommend against that too? Me personally, I'm not using prototypes or classes. And they do, like you say, feel very similar to me. If I am reaching for a class-based style of programming or object-oriented, I am also using classes and not just straight-up using prototypes. Does that mean you should or shouldn't? I can't necessarily say either way. I'm personally not reaching for either of those, but if I am, I'm reaching for straight-up classes. Why? I just like the syntax more. I know it's sugar. I know it's syntactical sugar, but I just like it more.
It's good sugar.
It's good sugar. That said, I almost never reach for classes, and I almost never reach for that object-oriented style of programming. Personally, I'm just not as skilled with it. So that's why. Wes, do you do any more classes than I do?
Sometimes in my tutorials, I will do something in a class just to show people how that works. Mm-hmm. In my everyday, I'm mostly functional or entirely functional. Unless a library uses it, JavaScript is kind of funny because like you can use a library that is totally built on prototypes and you can just use it in your functional programming, no problem. Or if you want to extend it. So I would say 96% of the time I'm using functional programming. So the question here that is like, if you're using prototypes, does it mean you're not doing functional programming? Mostly, but like you can mix and match them. It's not one or the other, and you're not going to get in trouble if you mix them here or there. And I would say, yeah, if you should probably move over to using classes. Maybe not you should, because obviously you know what you're doing here, but classes just make the authoring experience of writing object-oriented and prototypal inheritance code much nicer. So we shall say, like, there's nothing wrong with object-oriented. Just Scott and I tend to lean much more functional. Sometimes when we talk about stuff on this podcast, people think like, oh, object-oriented is bad because Wes and Scott don't use it. No, absolutely not. Like, probably half developers out there use object-oriented. And probably half the people listening to this podcast use that.
Yeah, it's funny because you can approach most of the problems in either way and be just fine. I ended up going functional mostly just because it feels normal to me. It feels right to me. I can't exactly put my finger on it. I found it easier to test specifically. And once I was like, oh man, having an individual function to test that individual function is just so nice and easy. I was just like, I'm just going to do this for... As a rule, but
yeah, I found myself, what were we doing? We're building a game in one of our courses where you have to like internalize the state and like you want to, like we have a game and you can have the score and you can do things with that game. I was like, this is much easier to write as a class because that class can hold state, that class can have methods. So I like rewrote it and I was like, oh, this makes much more sense.
Yeah. I think the only time I've used classes lately is for my jQuery, my GraphQL client that I wrote. Made way more sense to be a class.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Next question is from Jesus Sanchez. He says, hi, Scott and Wes. Love the podcast. I can't miss an episode as a Drupal developer. Well, more of a manager role now, working towards using a headless CMS. I wonder if at some point it'll be better just to switch to a CMS written in JavaScript. Just the other day, I was listening to another podcast where they mentioned the DX much, much better in the JavaScript world, but the CMSs are still way ahead in the PHP world. Would you agree with that assessment, or do you think that there are already JavaScript CMSs in position to keep with Drupal and its competitors? Thank you. Greetings from Spain. Let me tell you, this has been kind of a weird thing for a long time, right? We've often talked about this, right? It seems like there is, like, in terms of CMS world, you have the WordPresses and the Drupals, and then you just have this mystery land. I'm going to say that if you want to go ahead and look at JavaScript-based CMSs, Ghost is so underrated, it's not even funny. Ghost at ghost.org is a hugely underrated node-based CMS. And it's really good. It's really, really good. And it's JavaScript based. That said, you know, there's kind of like a weird world where, like, in, if you think about like CMSs, the CMS is like encompassing oftentimes like the templating, rendering language and stuff like that. You have the how the data interacts with things and the views that you're building. And if you're getting into the code at all in a CMS, you're doing so within their own templating language. And so I think that's the weirdest part coming from like a JavaScript world, right? Where you're used to writing things in React or whatever. You know, I'd really personally love a CMS where the templates could be written in Svelte or something if you wanted to do it that way. It just feels like there's not enough communication between packages or systems. I've often thought about building a CMS myself, but dang, what an undertaking, right? Yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, there's lots of them out there. I think people like the PHP CMSs because of the templating system, the plugin system, the theming system. You can pretty much hit the ground running and get something up and running very, very quickly in PHP world.
Lots of running, yeah.
And as soon as you go headless, it seems to be like, a lot of the CMSs, or all of them in JavaScript land, are headless. And as soon as you do that, you sort of give up a lot of the, oh, I needed a yoga booking plugin, and now I either have to use a service for that or build it myself. So you can't just go and slap a WordPress or Drupal plugin in there and get it up and running. So it's a little bit more frustrating, but certainly the CMSs in JavaScript land are very, very good. Keystone, one of my favorites. Strapi, also one of my favorites. Ghost is very, very good. Mm-hmm. Ghost has been around for probably 8 years now, and it is very stable. Yeah, I'd definitely take a look at those types of things.
Totally.
Let's talk about one of our sponsors, which is Auth0. Handles authentication and authorization for your application, so you don't have to. It's a service you can integrate into your application that gives you things like you can log in with your favorite social provider, Twitter, Google, Discord, etc. You can customize the login page. There's SDKs to integrate into Node, Express, React, Next.js, you name it. They have lots of features like user management, including roles and permissions, multi-factor authentication. It's very, very hard to build your own login system, especially once you get starting getting into roles and permissions. Go back and listen to the episode we did on roles and permissions. It's a lot. And then they also have things like device biometrics. Log in with Face ID or fingerprint scanner on your phone or your laptop. You name it. You want to check it out for your next project at Auth0. They have a really cool link here, a0.to/syntax. If you can't remember that, just click the link in the show notes. Thank you, Auth0, for sponsoring.
Sick.
Next question we have here is from Kilgore. I was disappointed by your guest, Adam Cowley's comments on being too old to learn new things. Maybe he meant it as a joke, but this industry has a serious ageism problem and it is not justified. I'm a full-time software engineer who is in their 50s using React, GraphQL, and TypeScript. Why do you think that this mindset with age comes an inability to learn, especially given how many devs are self-taught? I don't remember what Adam said there, but he was just joking. Maybe it's not something we should be joking about, because we've said many times on this podcast, you don't necessarily need, it doesn't matter what age you are in order to learn. It's more about the person and the mindset and the learning. I have friends who are 32, 34, who can't use a phone and are unable to to send an email or reset their password. And then I have other people, my dad is 60-something, 65, learns to code, listens to this podcast sometimes. I've had people in their 70s take my courses. It's the person. It's the mindset of being able to be a lifelong learner. What is that? Autodidact? What's the word for that?
I don't know. Those were just like a bunch of syllables I just heard. So I don't know.
Here, it's autodidact, a self-taught person. I think you are never too old to learn something. If anything, as I get older, I'm a better learner, because I feel like I can pick up stuff much quicker. It just in life in general, because I have worked on my ability to learn quickly. It's the hunger to learn. I think some of this like ageism stems from younger devs seem to have a lot more time, less dependence, less like mortgages to pay for. So it seems that they can, a lot of web development is essentially just throwing sheer time at the thing in the early days. And I think that's where it comes from, which is true, but it's not really an excuse for anyone. So apologies if that came off wrong, but I seriously think anybody at any age can learn this stuff.
Yeah, totally. You know what? It's funny because you mentioned some of that. Courtney and I were just talking about this because, you know, she's had to take a look a lot. My wife, for those of you who don't know, is a doctor of psychology, and she had to take a number of neurology brain studies courses. And she's talking about how, you know, the pathways in your brain essentially get more solidified over time. And maybe that's part of it too, where you're feeling like maybe stuck in your way because your brain pathways have solidified to a point where, like, even one of the previous comments on this episode was talking about not learning the new Flexbox stuff. Your brain has made it efficient for you to do the things that you always like to do. Your brain's always kind of working at an efficiency level. So, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe you're just like erosion, not that your brain has eroded, but like, just like water erodes a river, or a river erodes land, you know, these pathways in your brain can become more solidified over time in ways that your just brain's working on pure efficiency. So, you know, when people say that, you know, they're too old to learn something new, it could just be a feeling of like, I'm set in my ways. Maybe it's not that my age is preventing me from learning anything, but maybe that I'm personally feeling set in my ways or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're totally right. At any age, anybody can learn anything. In fact, we met one of the coolest dudes at, Reactathon recently. We had breakfast with this guy, and
he had a
career change. Like, I don't remember how old he was when he made his career change.
I think he's over 50.
He went to a boot camp and now he's working as a dev, and he was saying like how much more revitalized he's felt since becoming a developer because of how exciting it all is to be working in code and to learn all these new things. And man, he was just like, he was on it. He had picked up so much stuff. He had moved into like, you know, really, really like neat code stuff. And it was like really amazing to talk to him because it wasn't even just like he was, you know, older gentleman in general, but like he had made a late career change. And like all of a sudden I'm going from something that's not development to something that's development and just like absolutely thriving and loving it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, and totally.
So that guy also in the same conversation, he talked to us about his woodworking shop.
And oh, how yeah.
He's like, I was looking at the prices of kitchen cabinets. And I said, I'm going to learn to make kitchen cabinets.
Yeah, what a cool guy.
And like, I was like, if that's not like the perfect example of personality type of this guy learns to code and build a kitchen from like literally from wood. Like he didn't go to IKEA and assemble it. He literally learned how to, over the course of 2 years, how he built a wood shop and built an entire kitchen of that. And I was like, that's the person. That guy is really good at learning and he is never scared to take on some new project.
Okay. Next question is from Mike. I've been seeing a lot of bad press about Stripe lately on Twitter and Reddit. I keep hearing horror stories of funds getting held by Stripe for months and accounts getting frozen. I've used Stripe before and loved the developer experience, but now I'm hesitant to use it on future projects. Am I overreacting? Are there other payment providers you recommend, or should I stick with Stripe and hope for the best? This is very funny, not funny, so to say, but it's very interesting to me. When I say funny, sometimes I mean like curious. It's very interesting or curious to me because I have kind of largely not used Stripe. We were on Stripe for just a little bit, but we had so many people demanding PayPal support or international support that we couldn't give with Stripe. I just realized that Stripe was just straight up not viable for us to use. So we didn't use Stripe. And I've always been kind of sitting on the sidelines being like, man, really wish I had some of these nice Stripe developer APIs right about now. And it's interesting to see that there is some kind of change going on there. You know, I wonder if that is just something with becoming an older company, you know, maybe a bigger company where priorities have shifted from being like the developer type of deal to now we're just like this big giant corporation trying to make money. I couldn't tell you. Have you heard too much about this Stripe stuff, Wes? Because it really feels like payment processes in general are just kind of have always been a PIA, and Stripe was a breath of fresh air. And unfortunately, who knows what's going on there?
I'll say the Stripe's focus on developer stuff has not changed. The development experience is still as enjoyable and it's getting better and better. Over the years, I think a lot of I have this quote here as you either die a hero or live long enough to become PayPal. Mm-hmm. People hate PayPal for two reasons. First, the development experience is painful. They have lots of endpoints and different products and you can't figure out how to freaking just get it to work. And that has been changed a lot lately. But then the other part I think where people are mad at it is that these companies get so large that they attract a lot of bad people and they have to put processes in place to stop bad people from doing things. And if you hit, like, I don't know, if you open up a new account and all of a sudden make $5,000, that's going to raise flags in their internal systems. And they're going to, unfortunately, freeze your funds before they can get information about, like, what is this going to? Where is it going? A lot of times, I think both hosting providers and payment providers aren't allowed to say a lot of the sketchy, nefarious stuff that is happening behind the scenes. And the reason why things are often hard and weird is because they are trying to stop the bad guys from doing bad things. And that means that good people get caught up in it. So I don't know. I have heard a lot of these stories as well where straight funds get held up and whatnot. It's unfortunate. But I really, a lot of these companies that sort of like say, all right, we're going to be a startup and we're going to cut through the bureaucracy. You look at them a couple of years later and they realize, oh, there's a reason why these companies are so hard to deal with because the world is a complicated place. So I'm not trying to excuse any of these companies, certainly because there's companies like Wise out there that have just cut right through all the bureaucracy of doing international money. But that is the reason why. I don't think you really have to worry too much. And if I have anything to say, it's if you are thinking about setting up Stripe, sign up now and start getting all of your everything possible approved and cleared as quickly as you can, because when you need it, you're not going to have time to wait for that type of stuff.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And I think you're dead on. It's like, it feels like bad actors always ruin it for the rest of us.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
That's like one thing you learn in life as you get older. It's like, man, there's always going to be bad people doing bad stuff. And that stinks.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That stinks really bad. Cool. All right. Now
I think we've talked too much. Let's put these on the next potluck here.
I was going to say that. I was looking at the time and saying, okay. So now's the part of the show where we talk about sick picks. Picks that we think are sick, things that we have picked that we think are neat, or products or apps or anything that we like. Wes, sick picks. Did you have a sick pick for us today?
I do have a sick pick. This is a kitchen faucet, which is hilariously not the first time I've sick picked a kitchen faucet.
That is actually very unbranded.
So we just moved into a new house and the kitchen faucet was leaking and the water, I'm going to say water pressure. I always get bent out of shape of when people mix flow and pressure up. Flow is the amount that comes out of your tap, and pressure is obviously the pressure that comes out, and they are related, but not the same thing. But so we had this like leaky, brutal pressure. And like when I do things like clean a cutting board, if you can't get good pressure to rinse it off, then the cutting board never gets really clean. That's really frustrating. So I went to Home Depot and looked at all of them. And like all the faucets at Home Depot are like plastic nowadays. And they're the $300 for the ones I want. I wanted basically for my whole life, I wanted like a restaurant sprayer, you know, when you grab the big thing, it's on a spring. I was like, I want that. And our new house doesn't have cabinets overhead. So I was like, you know what? We're doing it. I'm doing it. So I went and researched all of them and I found one on Amazon, which I know people have groaned about Amazon stuff, but this thing was full stainless steel, super heavy, good quality, for $150 Canadian, which is like 115 American. And so that's like a third or a fourth of the cost of something that's not even as good from Home Depot. So I was like, I'm going to roll the dice on this thing. And this thing is freaking awesome. There's no, at least in Canada, you have to have flow restrictors in all of them. And I usually cut those out. There's no flow restrictor in this thing. I'm thinking about putting in a flow restrictor because of how much comes out. It's like it could cut your hand off how much pressure. It has both the sprayer as well as a little tap that you can move around. So two people can be working at the same time, or you can be filling one and spraying at the same time. It's awesome. Super high quality. I have no idea how like the stores are not filled with these amazing quality things. So I'll put a link to the show notes for this specific sprayer, but super handy. I posted it on Instagram and I have like 5 friends that already bought one.
You might have 6 in a minute here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to sick pick a podcast. I've linked to the website that has the podcast. It's literatureandhistory.com. This podcast has a dumb name. It's called Literature and History. That's the name of the podcast. But it's, you know, and I've listened to a lot of history podcasts, whether it is like hardcore history or any of these types. And I love history, love history podcasts in general. But this one explains things and ancient history. I mean, it starts ancient history over the course of like an hour to 2 hours in a way that's just so in depth and really just well executed without ever getting sleepy, boring. The guy isn't obnoxious, but he isn't at the same time. I don't know. He isn't boring. He's captivating. And I think he poses some interesting, real interesting questions overall about, you know, the nature of history or any given thing as he's going. It doesn't really have like a slant or something. It's just straight up. Here's the evidence. Here's the books that we have. Here's what's in these books. And, you know, here's why it's important. And here's these stories and kind of how they all relate. And man, this podcast is good. So Literature and History is probably the best history podcast I have found lately. If that's your type of thing and you haven't heard of this one, give it a check. And I started at the very beginning and got to say, very, very good. So give it a listen. Shameless plugs.
Go for it.
Now is the part of the show where we plug our things, the stuff that we're doing. I'm going to shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. It's the website that I've been working on for over 10 years now, where I do web dev tutorials. So if you're interested in learning web dev topics, we have a new topic every single month. And honestly, over the next few months, we're going to be having more than that. So more than just one course a month, including a bunch of new stuff for me. And I'm going to be doing some courses on SvelteKit and Supabase and maybe TRPC and lots of CSS stuff as well. So check it out, leveluptutorials.com.
I got it.
Also, if your company is looking for tutorial courses, you can sign up your whole company all in one fell swoop. Get everybody nestled in there in one account and your company can pay for it. So that'd be really cool. Leveluptutorials.com. Thanks.
I shamelessly plug westboss.com/courses. You can pick up a JavaScript or CSS course on there. A bunch of free ones, a bunch of paid ones. Putting out new ones all the time. You can use coupon code SYNTAX for $10 off. I also have team licenses as well. So you can grab 10 spots, 20 spots, 1,000 spots for your team and divvy them up. It's much cheaper that way. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll catch you on Friday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.